Welcome to a live edition of Talking History, and very happy to have Professor Ray von Fouché here from the STS Department, Science and Technology Studies Department at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Dr. Fouché is a specialist in African American inventors, science and race, technology and race, and all of those topics that you rarely hear discussed among historians of technology and historians of science. And Dr. Ray von, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm going to start off by asking you how you got interested in the field itself.
I guess that's a long story, but initially I was planning to be a physician, but I took a course in history of chemistry, and that came from the experiences of when I was taking undergraduate courses in chemistry and asking the professor. You would go through this series of named reactions and ask him, well, who are these people? What were their names? And generally, he would kind of dismiss my questions, or finally, he would just get upset and said, I don't know. So the process was taking a course in history of chemistry as an undergraduate, and that led to my exploration of history of science and technology, and that's basically how it began.
And you were trained in at Cornell University. So when you went to Cornell, you did your graduate studies at Cornell.
Yes.
Did you come in as a specialist in history of science?
Yes. Initially, I ended up changing the projects I was working on to looking at race, science, technology. But initially, I came in to study late 19th, mid-19th century history of chemistry. Mm-hmm. So obviously, my interest changed substantially over the period I was at Cornell.
Now, you've published a book titled Black Inventors in the Age of Segregation. That, I assume, was originally your dissertation?
Yes.
How did you get interested in that aspect?
Initially, the project started very slowly. A friend's grandmother gave me an article listing some inventions by black inventors. And the rhetoric of the article was that if a black person hadn't invented this device, we wouldn't be able to experience certain things. The one thing that caught me most poignantly was the ice cream scoop. A black inventor received a patent for an ice cream scoop. And the way the article is written is that if he hadn't patented this device, we would not be able to experience the pleasures of ice cream, which, of course, is ridiculous. But that had me thinking about, so what is the importance of this kind of rhetoric? What's the meaning of technology in the lives of African American people? Because the idea of patenting is a very powerful concept and idea, and people are very interested in promoting it in certain different ways.
Well, that whole thing of identifying certain inventions with African Americans, I know women's studies went through a similar phase. Women were there too. Women did this too.
Yes.
It was sort of a phase in the field, in the development of the field, but
yes.
Very simplistic and,
yes.
And in many ways degrading. Phase.
Well, I think the problems I have with it is that it ends up reducing people to a name, a device, and often a patent number. And we know very little about these people outside of that. And some of these people are very interesting. Some are controversial. Some are problematic. But I was interested in giving these people more, like I say, three-dimensionality, because these people were living human beings. They had beliefs, and oftentimes they contradicted what they were trying to do in certain ways. So I was very interested in just understanding these black inventors as human beings, not just as simple inventors.
Mm-hmm. And the book looks at three inventors. Maybe you can sort of summarize the book and focus in on these three inventors and what drew you to them and what's interesting about their stories.
Well, the three inventors I looked at are Granville Woods. He's most known as the most prolific black inventor of the late 19th, early 20th century. Lewis Latimer, and the kind of mythology surrounding him is he's the inventor that invented the light bulb that Thomas Edison stole it from. And the last person is Shelby Davison, who actually was an attorney in Washington, D.C., and worked for the Treasury Department for several years. And part of the reason I chose these three individuals was very pragmatic, that a lot of these individuals don't have many documents. So I chose the people that I could find the most documents on, the people that were in the most kind of legal battles that could create a story and narrative about their existences. So I guess I'll start talking about the first inventor, Louis Latimer. He was born in 1848 and died in 1930. And what's interesting about Latimer is that he was the son of a person named George Latimer, who was and actually was born as his parents were escaping slavery. So what's very interesting about Latimer, and particularly his father, is that there was the George Latimer North Star. Many of the prominent abolitionists in the Northeast would take him around as an example of articulate former slave who, and this is some of the reasons why we should work to abolish slavery. And he had a very tough early life. His father disappeared shortly after the excitement of the anti-slavery movements and was never to be seen again. And he ended up working from place to place. But he began his training as an office boy in a patent law firm. And it was through his desire and good communication with the draftsman, he actually learned how to draft. So eventually, through the years and series of working with the draftsman, he eventually became the chief draftsman of this patent firm. And that was going well until new management didn't like the idea of having a black draftsman. So he was fired. He moves to Bridgeport, Connecticut with his sister, and he becomes a paper hanger. And then eventually he's doing some part-time drafting at some small companies in Bridgeport, and Hiram Maxim, who actually was one of the early players in the electric lighting business, but he's more known for patenting the machine gun. And Maxim saw his work and thought it was really exceptional. So he hires Latimer right away to become the draftsman for a lot of the electrical lighting work that they're doing. He worked for a company called United States Electric Lighting, which actually they had the second incandescent light bulb on the market, reaching the market about 6 months behind Thomas Edison's bulb. And he did very well moving back and forth, but eventually he went to London, came back, and he couldn't find a job. He thought he would have a very easy time finding a position because of all his connections. He was a very good draftsman. So what ended up happening, he worked for several second and third tier electric lighting companies for a period of 4 or 5 years. And at the end of that period, it was the same time where the Edison light bulb was being contested in the patent within the patent. Well, the patent was being contested. So it ends up happening that Latimer, since he was so well known through these second and third tier companies, pretty much all the companies that were attacking Edison, the Edison company hires him and he becomes part of the legal department. A very shrewd move because he knows all the second and third tier players. So Latimer becomes this really important internal legal consultant. And there are certain instances where he can say, well, no, that's wrong because I knew him at that moment. He's lying. So he could really sort out the whole story. And eventually, he became a kind of valued member of the Edison companies. And he died in 1930, a fairly well-off man, one of the first black families to move into Flushing, New York. His daughter talks about playing on their tennis court. So he had a very kind of successful, wonderful life.
Are there general lessons that you learn by looking at the life of Latimer?
Well, I think the more troubling thing that is complicated about Latimer is that oftentimes the black inventors are understood to invent for the race. They invented to support the race and prove that black people were equal to any people on the planet. But it gets very complicated when you start looking at Latimer in the sense that he was an assimilationist in the most harsh sense of the word. And one case that I write about in the book that clearly makes this point plain is that at one point, Booker T. Washington comes to speak in Boston, and William Monroe Trotter, one of the people that's very much against the Booker T. Washington agenda, comes in and tries to present a list of 8 questions. There ends up being kind of a hubbub, and then the police come and take them out. So when William Monroe Trotter publishes this list of 8 questions in The Guardian, and then eventually Latimer writes Booker T. Washington about 6 or 7 months later, answering all the questions in the way he should have. And he's even more conservative than people would assume Booker T. Washington to be. and makes comments like, well, black people should not be interested in the vote because they're not capable at this moment. So he comes off as being this tremendously conservative black person saying that, well, black people that are educated like me should, you know, think very carefully about what they want the rest of the black people to do. So in many ways, he's not the standard race champion we would think the traditional black inventor to be.
Normally would have been one of the talented tenth, but didn't choose to go in the direction of the Du Bois.
No, I mean, he believed in, I think, probably the talented oneth, and he was definitely not in the camp of Du Bois at all.
Uh-huh. How about the other inventors?
The other inventor, what I find very interesting, is one of the people is Granville Woods. He was born in 1856 and died in 1910. He's the most prolific black inventor of the period, some 54 patents. And what I find most interesting about his story is that he is presented also as one of these great champions of black inventors. However, he wasn't born in the United States, and he was not African-American. Actually, he's more of Aboriginal African descent. But what's interesting about his case is that if we're, you know, looking at his kind of racial genealogy, he's actually probably about a quarter African, which in the context of late 19th century America was plenty black enough to be considered a black person. However, what's very interesting about it is that he didn't necessarily consider himself to be black. And he used his blackness to his advantage at certain times when people called him the greatest inventor of his race, the Black Edison. He accepted that wholeheartedly. However, when certain things weren't being black wasn't to his advantage, he didn't. He acknowledged that. Well, I'm not necessarily Black American. So, what's interesting? I would say he's the most tragic story because he had the best idea. He started working on early process of electric railway locomotion. Some people say that he invented the third rail, but his work was similarly related to that, but not necessarily that close. And what happened with him is that the sad part about it is that since he was fairly poor, he ended up having to work with some very shady characters. One of the characters was James Zerbe, who was a patent solicitor. And at the time, patent solicitors are kind of a combination of lawyers, marketing agents, business consultants. They're kind of the jack of all trades. Mainly, they're just helping you get to the patent office and sell it to someone. But what ends up happening, James Zerbe has been known throughout the United States for cheating people. So he's been moving from state to state to state. And Woods hooks up with him. But it's interesting, near the end, Woods understood what kind of character Zerbe was. So it was this kind of battle of wits between these two people trying to steal the idea. And what brought everything to a conclusion is that Woods had created the series of drawings for the invention that he thought was going to be his most successful idea. Zerbe ends up stealing the drawings and hires another inventor to go to the patent office with his ideas. So when they find this out, Woods and Zerbe end up having a fight in their office. His son gets involved. It's in the newspapers. Zerbe sues Woods for libel, and they end up going to court for several years. And what ends up happening is the ideas, in a sense, go stale because Zerbe and Woods end up being in court for the ideas for about a decade. So by the time they finally settle it and the pieces can be patented, the moment has passed. So then he's, you know, struggling again, and around 1905, he starts getting connected with General Electric and selling some of his ideas to General Electric, but he dies in 1910 of a heart attack, poor and living in New York City.
So in spite of the dozens of patents, he was still poor.
Yeah, because that's another thing I was trying to work against, the mythology that, well, if you receive a patent, you'll become grossly successful and rich. Most of the patents, he was calling them pot boilers, meaning that he was just figuring out a way to raise a little bit of money. And usually he would end up breaking even because he would borrow some money to patent for the device, and then he would end up selling it to some company, and that would cover his expenses, if that.
Mm-hmm. So, how about the third one, Davidson?
Shelby Davidson was part of the black elite in Washington, D.C. He was well off that as at Howard University, where he was undergraduate, he was able to have two rooms. So a very well off student. What's interesting about Davison is that initially he was actually kicked out of Howard University for apparently having a woman in his room, which of course in the late 19th century was just way out of line. So he eventually was able to get his Howard degree and began working for the government and working his way up through the Treasury Department. And what he was doing, he was working on adding machines, which, you know, in the late 19th century was the highest level of technology in kind of this this area. And what he was working to do is, in what he said, invent the most complete and sophisticated adding machine environment in the world. So he was inventing the adding machine devices, the tables. He was doing a combination of architecture, industrial design, all of these things, bringing them together. And what actually ended up happening with Davison is that around when the Taft administration started to resegregate the government, he was slowly and surely pushed out of his high-level position. And he appealed to several individuals that had helped him along the way, but that just was not possible. So he ended up dealing and going into his real estate company, which was actually very successful. So it's a tragic story about his experiences in the process of working for the Treasury Department, but he was shrewd enough, knowledgeable enough to be able to negotiate Washington, D.C.'s kind of racial dynamics very well.
So you studied the careers of these three men, and what patterns did you see that were common and that help us understand the role of black inventors in and the obstacles that they faced in American society?
Yeah, I think what's interesting to me is that with the inventors, it's in thinking about history and technology in general, what's very interesting about these three individuals is that traditionally when we look at history of technology and invention, the focus is always on the big winners. Thomas Edison, Elmer Sperry, all the people we know and talk about it because they're tremendously successful. But we know very little about the people that weren't grossly successful. We know very little about what it meant to be a marginal inventor in trying to invent for your living. And I think that's what's interesting about Woods is that was all he did. He invented for his job, whereas Davison was a government employee, so he had a government salary. He had his real estate company on the side. Latimer was working for General Electric as a draftsman, so he was kind of inventing on the side. But it tells us a lot about what it means to be a second-tier inventor. But it also gives us another kind of look into the connections between technology, invention, and race during that period. And questioning, so how does a black person in the late 19th century get involved in the process of race? And what's really interesting is that a lot of black inventors would sell their ideas right away to patent solicitors because they just felt they weren't going to get a fair shake in the patent office. Things were going to get very, very difficult for them. But what's interesting is that in the early 20th century, a man named Henry Baker became the first black patent examiner. And at the moment, I'm working on a project trying to sort out his connections to black inventors and their community in Washington, D.C. So
that's fascinating. Just a lot of the sources that you use are patent office, the actual patent records.
Yes.
that you work your way. What can you learn? What can you learn from a patent document?
Yeah, I think the patent documents are one I consider to be still the one most unused resource in the National Archives. Besides getting tremendously dirty when you're looking through them, since you're probably the patent documents I was looking for, I was probably the first person to look at the documents since they were put in the box, you know, 90 years ago. But what's interesting about the documents is that what's contained in them. The language is that there's a patent wrapper. So what ends up being in the patent wrappers are the correspondence with the patentee, meaning that, well, you submit your patent, the patent office writes back, and they'll have all the documents saying what's wrong, what needs to be changed, all the people looking at them. But the other part of the documents that I was used very a lot were called patent interference cases, which an interference happens when an individual submits an application for a patent on a certain device. Within a certain period, another individual submit an application on a similar device. So instead of having these two people hash it out, it goes to through the interference process, which ends up being somewhat like a legal process of figuring out who was the first person to invent. And often the interference cases are very short, because one person kind of acknowledges, well, that person actually invented the idea before me, or they fight it out. And with Woods, for instance, there are over 2,000 pages of interference testimony. And I think what was interesting about that was, for a historian, there are these certain kernels in the interference testimony that you just can't believe how fortunate you are. Situations like, you know, the patent attorney is asking him, well, where were you for this year-long period of your life? What did you do? Who did you talk to? And all those certain things that are pretty much impossible to find out unless someone has asked that question and it's documented. So with Woods, I had a very easy time kind of documenting his movements, because at every kind of moment in these interference cases, everyone wants to know where you are, what you're doing, who you know, who you talk to, where you're working, which is really kind of a potent piece of historical evidence.
The patent documents also contain a lot of racial coding in there, a lot of language, or at least some, because I think you refer to some of the references about the race of the I forgot, one of the lawyers, in one of your pieces, there's a quotation about the plow or something about I don't have it in my head exactly.
This is a part of an interference case with Woods, is that the other thing that's a big struggle is the kind of conception of black disingenuity, that mm-hmm. black people were not capable of being technologically sophisticated. And there's a few important cases. And there's a case in 1848 when a plantation owner had a slave named Ned who invented a new cotton scraper. So he goes to the patent office and says, well, I haven't invented this, but since I own my sled name, Ned, I should be able to receive a patent for this and, you know, earn income off this idea. The patent office writes back and says, well, we can't grant patents to slaves. And if we granted the patent to you, since we know you didn't invent it, we can't protect you from that. So now the argument is that, well, since a slave is not a citizen, and a patent is a legal document to give property rights to a citizen, then that idea is kind of up for grabs. Which is...
Never even thought about this.
Yeah.
So what happened?
So he didn't patent it.
So any time a slave invented anything, it disappears, the record of it?
It ends up being this kind of personal record, because there's no patent record for it, because there's no reason to patent it or spend the money to patent it if you can't protect it. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is that this rhetoric of, black lack of technological activity moves into the period after that. And in the interference case with Woods, there's a statement where one of the patent examiner says, well, everyone knows that the horse hay rake was invented by a lazy Negro or a lazy slave who didn't want to rake the field by the hand, which is, to me, completely ridiculous that, well, he's saying that black people were so lazy that they were being creative. So it kind of has this idea that, well, it strips black people at this time of any creative ability. Even their creativity was kind of spun in a negative light, that, well, he invented this thing because he was too lazy to do it by hand, instead of saying, well, it wasn't really great that he's able to get a lot of more work done than less in a shorter period of time.
Hmm. Fascinating story. For those people interested, the title of the book is called Black Inventors in the Age of Segregation, and it's John Hopkins University Press, published in 2003. And since that book, you've moved into an area which for me is more interesting, even though, I mean, not to say that your work on these three inventors, but it's, I think, more sophisticated in the way you're approaching the whole issue of science, technology, and race, and cultural invention, the whole concept of culture, how inventions have a cultural component, so that You talk both about the process of invention and the process of appropriating inventions.
Yeah.
Can you talk about this new direction that you're, if it is indeed new?
Yeah, I mean, these are some of the things I've been thinking about for a long time, and I'm still kind of working on and developing. But this next project has more a theoretical agenda, and thinking about ways to theorize and conceptualize, thinking about the connections between African Americans, but not only just African Americans, I would just call them other racially marginalized peoples and technology. And part of this kind of work comes from the work of another professor here at RPI, Langdon Winner, who in many ways is a guiding light in shaping how I think about the world in many ways. And he wrote a very famous article, you know, entitled "Do Artifacts Have Politics?" And the general idea is that, well, what kind of political beliefs, ideologies, and concepts get embedded into the material artifacts of our world. And I'm interested in how race is influenced or valenced through technologies. So what does it mean for an African American to invent something? Are they imparting some of their experience into that? Because I believe that everything people invent or create and get themselves involved with, they impart some of their own kind of personal experience, knowledge, or understanding of their world. And how does that understanding of a world inflect or influence how this technology plays out? Yeah, there are a lot of like theoretical concepts that I'm playing with to try to, you know, understand what it means for African Americans to know technology.
Just to make it a bit concrete on the production side, you talk about the example of photography and how there's a racial element in photographic technology. Could you explain that?
Yeah, this comes from some of the work of a cultural theorist called Richard Dyer and a book called White. And In this book, he argues, which I'm in support of and kind of trying to push this argument a little further, is that, well, he looks at a most basic level, but the kind of concept of photography and how photographic equipment was created and built. And the idea is that photographic equipment was designed to capture the white skin better than brown or other different colors of skin. And what ends up happening is that the brown skin is considered to be a problem in photographing people. And so there have been different techniques. Traditionally, you need more light. People would put a certain kind of early 20th century, certain kind of chemicals on people's skin to make them show up better on film. And the argument is that, well, if we're designing technologies that privilege a certain group of people, what does that say about how our technological production? It's very complicated when you think about, well, I mean, it's understandable how it happens, because, of course, the people that I'm sure that are creating, designing, inventing early photographic equipment were taking pictures of themselves, which ended up to be, you know, mostly white Americans or white people around the world. And then when you move to browner people and it's not coming out as well, the argument is that, well, it's not the technology that's problematic. It's the people that's problematic. Uh-huh. The people. So in a sense, you have to fix their skin rather than fix the technology to do the job better.
Uh-huh. On the consumption side, you also argue, and we don't have much time, so I want to sort of end on this. It's fascinating that African Americans and other marginalized people have appropriated technology and reinvented it. And you give the wonderful example of Grandmaster Flash and scratching. Could you go into that? And
yeah, I mean, this is one of my most exciting projects right now that I'm really great, really excited to work on this with actually a musicologist, individually Mark Katz at Johns Hopkins. And, well, the idea is that traditionally a record player and a vinyl record were designed to produce and enable you to listen to pre-recorded music. But then you have individuals like Grandmaster Flash and other DJs who all of a sudden have changed this technology of listening to pre-recorded music to a technology that produces music. So scratching is basically the manual manipulation of a vinyl record in the opposite direction to produce clearly a scratching noise. This noise, which as a child I was always told to not do that, but now it becomes this way of engaging and interacting with music in a new way. And I think what's interesting about that is the thing that I'm working on right now is this move from analog turntables to digital turntables, which analog turntables are clearly the traditional turntables that use a vinyl record, but now they have digital turntables that allow you to use a compact disc. But what's interesting to me is the idea of cultural compression, is that when you move from a traditional vinyl turntable, which has this larger cultural practice of listening to records, pulling records, and understanding the kind of dynamics of this music, to the digital turntable, which just allows you to slip a compact disc in there and manipulate this plastic disc. What ends up happening is all these cultural practices and cultural knowledge around scratching gets compressed into lines of code and algorithms that are pumping out the ability to scratch. So in a sense, with digital turntables, you're able to scratch a lot better, a lot quicker, a lot easier than with the vinyl turntables, because the digital turntables always perform the same way. But for people who've used vinyl records, everyone knows that certain vinyl records are a little more warped than others. Some are thicker. Some are they're all different, and that requires a level of skill that's not the same within the digital realm.
So this is an example of how hip-hop culture transforms the codes and transforms software and hardware.
Yeah.
Right. Wonderful, wonderful story. And I wish we had more time to go into it in detail. What you're doing is really cutting edge and exciting work in history, in the history of technology, looking at how race and technology and science interact and intersect. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.